But the rest of you, I believe, watch Contact. How did you enjoy that? Did people find that interesting? Good. Yeah, it has a lot to it, and you know, if you read the last chapter or the last couple of pages of the actual novel, it also it's really quite fascinating, all of that.
We felt that having heard about Carl Sagan, that it made the film so much more poignant.
Yes.
In terms of the search for truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the fact that she had no evidence when she came back, and you know, it made it live a lot more, I think.
Apart from just that 18 hours of static, which they seem to gloss over.
Wasn't that interesting, isn't it? That,
so I was thinking, how much was there? How much was there? And then they said.
And it's sort of intriguing, you know, seeing these two, you know, representatives of faith and science, you know, kind of sparring with each other.
And yet at the end, it was two separate worlds still. It was, you know, bound by two different covenants, was one of the phrases. And she was appealing to experience without evidence.
Yeah.
So there was no suggestion that you could actually have a faith which had evidence.
And you know, and I think it's you know, it is part of our part of everyone's regular experience that you know, that we there's what we see, and then we're called to walk by faith, not by sight. So we always have this sort of double seeing, double orientation. We're oriented to the world, and but we're also oriented to God. And I think it's not an easy kind of dance between those two. Even as Randall was talking about, outwardly we're wasting away, but inwardly we're being renewed. And we can sort of separate those things out in some kind of an ultimate divide. I think that's a mistake. That's a sort of Platonic kind of dualism where you kind of create this little world of faith up here and then the practical realities down here. But in fact, you know, God has invaded this world. And he is calling us to an eschaton. He's calling us eschatologically to, you know, where heaven and earth meet. You know, the New Jerusalem is that sort of meeting place where the integration is full. But at the moment, the integration is not complete, and so we feel these tensions. And so it's not surprising that, you know, in the secular world, there is that tension as well. But only sometimes the chasm is much, much greater, and is sometimes made much greater than it need be. You know, so science on this side, faith on that side, religion on that side. I think the wonderful thing about the Bible is how, you know, you have this constant commingling of these features. Yeah, sure.
But Palmer's early question to her was a question about evidence when he appealed to her experience of the love of her father and her brought him her love for her father.
Yes.
And that's not evidence.
Yeah, no, that's right. And as Rosie says, you know, even at the very, very end, although she had to take it on faith, her experience, there was that missing 18 hours evidence. And this is one thing I do think that Richard Dawkins is right in a way, is, you know, he gets very frustrated with what he calls the those who advocate NOMA. The acronym is non-overlapping magisteriums, meaning that you've got science here and you've got faith here, and they don't overlap. They just completely divide. They're just two different realities, and we should never worry about them conflicting. If you think there's a conflict, it's just you're making a category mistake, and we can live in both realities at the same time. He gets very frustrated with that. because he feels that gives far too much protection to faith. And which is precisely why many people of faith like that idea. Because it does give protection. Because then you don't have to worry about the evidence. You don't have to worry about factual reality. Just whatever happens there, my faith is secure here, floating in the air. So this sort of nomen, non-overlapping magisteria, it's very, very popular as a way to solve the problems. But he gets, and he's right, he says, the God hypothesis should be testable. That's the way he puts it. Now he frames it in a very scientific way, which sort of skews the debate so that he's arguing on his grounds, which are empiricist grounds. And that's a problem. But the notion that the God hypothesis should be testable, you know, simply what Jesus said, taste and see. Taste and see. I mean, he has not left himself without a witness. There is evidence. It may not be empirical evidence of the scientific kind, but it is still signs and pointers witnesses that testify to the reality of God in this world.
Historical evidence was also inadmissible. She had seen with her own eyes this other world, but she didn't seem able to say, I saw, I'm an eyewitness.
Yeah.
That is historically admissible as evidence.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
It had to be something repeatable in a
yes.
Test tube.
Yeah. I know a fellow in Minneapolis who's just written a book on the epistemic virtue of personal testimony. Because we've often, again, you know, it's the notion that the God hypothesis is testable, I think, is correct. But we need to realize that the instruments that we test that with need to be much given a much greater range than simply the instruments of science. It's like, even within science, you don't do astronomy through a microscope. That's the wrong instrument to look at the stars. You're not going to see anything of the stars if you look through a microscope. So getting the right instrument is important. And unfortunately, a lot of the hardline sort of naturalists are deeply committed to empiricism. They only want certain kinds of evidence admitted. They don't want to admit rational reasoning. They don't want to admit personal testimony. And personal testimony, of course, is central to the way most of us know most of what we do know, because we hear it from others, starting with our parents. And most of what they tell us is reliable, you know, starting with what time is supper? You know, and that's kind of our basic epistemology is routed through the authority and the reliability of personal testimony. And so when we have testimony to historical events, that's very, very important. Yeah.
Is it think to some extent that our identity actually socially constructed?
To some extent, yes. Yes, the postmodern observations are not new. They're very old. I mean, the Greeks understood the role of the subjective. But the postmoderns have really elaborated on the degree to which we are socially constituted. Because we grow up in cultures, we grow up in society, in community, and we are shaped by the thinking and the actions and the structures that we inherit. And there's some degree of arbitrariness to that. But I think that insight is pushed too far when it separates away from a given reality, as if there's no referent back to reality. Now, we may have to go back some ways. We may have to peel back some layers of social construct, even in our own identity. We may have to pull the layers back. And a bit like an onion, sometimes you wonder if there's anything in there. You keep pulling layer after layer. The postmodern vision is that it is like an onion. There's nothing. It's just layers. You know, sort of elephants all the way down sort of thing. That's right.
Social constructivism, for example.
Yeah.
Doesn't deny reality. It is a way of looking at the phenomena than that is deny reality.
Well, some wouldn't deny reality, you're correct, but that is sometimes left ambiguous. And such is the focus on everything is just led, everything is constructed, that for many people, the cash out of that is to feel entirely lost and to feel that we're living in a situation where there's nothing given, nothing fixed. And therefore, everything is to a certain extent false, including ourselves, and we don't know who we are. And there's a loss of identity through that. But what we can say as Christians is no, that there is something fixed. Human beings were created in the image of God. We were given a fixed identity. We are called to a new identity in Christ. And so our identity as human beings has two pinpoints, two fixed points, where we have come from, Adam, and where we are going, the second Adam. And this fixes who we are. Now, within that, there's of course a great deal of malleability, and we get to make choices about who we are, and we get to be conformed, and we get to be constructed by culture, and we can deconstruct some of that construction helpfully. Some of us need deconstructing. Many people would look at me and say, I need a lot of deconstructing because I'm an unreconstructed guy. Then some of us resist that, which is part of why I'm an unreconstructed guy, because I resist that. But that's a bit of a dance, a cultural dance. And we can play those games and it's fine, but let's not get too carried away and think that we're totally free in that. What was that t-shirt? Jonathan just saw a t-shirt yesterday. What did it say?
Reality is something that happens to you when you're not playing computer games.
You get that? Reality is something that happens to you when you're not playing computer games. And you could say the same sorts of thing. You know, reality is something that catches up with you when you think you're just playing social reconstruction. Because reality is really there. And you go to any hospital, you know, and suddenly social reconstruction, all that fades as you see someone, a human being, who is approaching, you know, a kind of a reality that no one can avoid, no one can construct away. So that's all I'm arguing for, Sujan, is that there's a fixed point, not denying the role of the subjective or the role of culture. In fact, the Bible recognizes, that's why Paul says, you know, do not be conformed to the patterns of this world. I mean, you know, there's postmodernism right there. The world has patterns and it conforms us. But we can be free of it when he says, do not. Now, many postmodernists would say it's impossible to break free. It's impossible to break free. Now, that's the problem. The hope of the gospel is, of course we can break free. We have the power of Christ at work. Something new has begun. And so we can be renewed by our mind. And this is where, again, the desire of the postmodern to humble the Enlightenment mind is very, very admirable. The Enlightenment mind, the veneration of reason and the rationalism of modernity was demonic and needed to be substantively critiqued. But to reject reason is an overreaction that actually robs us of a wonderful tool that God wants to use in our transformation, because we are set free from conformity to the structures around us. Do not be conformed, by the renewing of the mind. It's through the mind that the Holy Spirit works in us and enlightens us. And the mind is the seat of the will, of the personhood. It is there that we can become reformed and grow in an abiding identity in Christ that is ultimately free from all the shaping that goes on around us. And that is a wonderful promise to hold on to. And the mind is a key in that. And so I worry in the over correction in regard to reason. And I go back to the thing of modernity. Modernism created the machinery of modernity. And we're still living it. And that machinery is still running full tilt. And if postmodernism robs us of the mind, it sort of lobotomizes us, says, well, you know, there's no right or wrong, no true or false. We're hopelessly ensnared and entrapped in language games. We can't know reality. It robs us of the very thing that should enable us to get back in some degree of control of this machinery. Because if we're not, then I think we just get carried along with it. And someone else will come along who has a more robust sense of connection to reality and who is willing to grab the reins. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So.
Well,
yeah.
Not only says don't be conformed, he also says I became all things to all men.
Yeah.
So he made use of the social realities that there were there of other people.
Yeah.
And then the most impressive evidence that we are socially constructed is the lack of social construction of feral children who have been raised by wild beasts, mm-hmm. who are unable really to enter into normal human society.
Right. Yeah.
Plus, I think looking at life of Jesus, he talked and discussed two most contented realities, heaven and hell. Jesus talked more about hell than heaven. So these are, if you believe in Jesus, then you believe in what he said. So these are not tangible realms or realities. One cannot deconstruct or construct further. But simply because Jesus said these things, I want to believe that there is a fixed position as heaven and hell,
these
bipolar positions, and within which all those constructions, deconstructions, and realities, or non-realities, have to be dealt with.
That's right. Yeah, because time is this great gift within which we have amazing freedom. But it's also bewitching because it lures us into thinking that we are ultimately free, but we're not. Time is bound, and one of those boundaries is creation, and I don't believe that creation is ever undone. God preserves it. Even the feral child does not lose the image of God. You know, the creation is one bound. Then the eschaton is the other. You know, death sort of is, in a sense, the harbinger of that eschaton. It reminds us, you know, death and taxes, you know, the things that we cannot avoid. Because they both say that there's going to be a time when we have to, you know, do accounting for this flow of time in which we have all this freedom and all this creativity and all this flux and flow. You know, at a certain point, there's going to have to be an accounting. And that is, of course, you know, the eschaton. And that's another fixed point. So we must always have this eternal perspective. But we can have it with hope because of the resurrection. And we can know those first fruits now.
Because we've got a better accountant.
We've got a great accountant, yeah, exactly. We've got a wonderful accountant with deep pockets. And so, you know, we can live with hope. But we do still live with hope. We're in this flowing of life and all its flow and its complexity. And we can elucidate that through science, which looks at the sort of the the empirical elements of it, or we can look at it through the eyes of sort of the postmodern observations, which focus more on the cultural, the subjective, and both are real, and both are highly complex, and we can get lost in the subatomic particles, and we can get lost in the language games of literary critics. I mean, there's endless explorations in these worlds. But what we need to remember is that they're only partial reflections of the fullness of reality. They're not entirely invalid, and they often have good insights. Yeah, particles do kind of work like that, and yes, language games do work like that, but that's not the fullness of reality. And so often, again and again and again, people get an insight and they totalize it. And the irony is that, you know, postmodernism was supposed to deliver us from totalizing narratives. But postmodernism itself can become a totalizing narrative where everything is socially constructed. And that becomes the one insight which then gets totalized, gets cast over everything. And we need to sort of limit and say, yeah, it's a helpful insight, but you know, physics still is there. But then even physics is only part of it. And all these things come together, I think, within the biblical meta-narrative. It's the fixed points of creation and consummation. And then, of course, you know, that stake in the ground, which is the cross, where Christ, God himself, enters and creates a fulcrum for humanity and for our reinterpretation of everything. And the Word of God is the spectacle that, as a Christian, we now put on that worldview. And it helps reorient, and all these other perspectives get reoriented in their proper place, so we can acknowledge the physics, and we can acknowledge the cultural construction, and we can acknowledge all the other insights that, you know, human history has thrown up, but we can put them in places so that they become constructive rather than idolatrous. And when they're isolated and given total power over this, they become idolatrous. Like community, we're talking about community. Then it becomes idealized and politicized, and it becomes communism, and it becomes totalizing. And you can see how wonderful and good thing suddenly becomes a source of oppression, and people get trapped in it and can't find their way out, because they've sort of, the logic of it is, this is all there is. There's only the state, and that's the whole reality. So it's incredibly important that we really see the power, the liberating power, that the truth sets you free, that God's word really sets us free by enabling us to relativize all these different paradigms, so we don't end up entrapped in any one of them. I want to move on. Do you have any other questions? I'm kind of going a little bit further because I know Sujon has wanted to get onto these discussions for a long time, so I don't want to belabor it for others, but I want to continue a little bit thinking about the postmodern mind this morning, but perhaps bring it down out of the more intellectual, philosophical discussion into the felt experience of many, many people today, particularly young people, and cash it out a little bit. Because as with modernity, there's not too many Richard Dawkins walking down the sidewalks, you know, who've thought it all through from first principles and are thoroughgoing modernists. However, that worldview impacts multitudes of people in varying degrees. And so it's useful to kind of look at it in the abstract, because then we see it reflected in different people in different degrees. And we say, oh, I can see where that idea has come from in you. Now, you may not be necessarily a modernist, and we shouldn't just label people modernists, but it's a useful way of understanding perhaps the ideas that are shaping people. Same thing with postmodernism. Not many people are reading Richard Rorty or studying Foucault. Not many people have really got their head around all of this. But the ideas filter down. People pick them up, doing their, you know, sort of literature classes or anthropology or whatever at university, and they pick up some of these ideas, and it becomes part of the zeitgeist. And so I want to look at how that works out in a younger generation. Initially, I think observers noted a generational distinction back in the 90s that was quite marked, but they didn't quite know what it meant. But the shift from a post-war generation, often called the baby boomers, to their children seem dramatic. And this new generation seemed dramatically different. And so a lot of investigation went in there. Now, that's some time ago. At the time, that new generation was labeled Generation X. Since then, of course, time has flowed on. And subsequent generations have been labeled Generation Y. And then people sort of thought, well, this is going to get a bit silly. and so then you hear you know, other ones, 21st century generation. I think millennial generation is a pretty good term. And I know someone who's done a PhD thesis on the difference between Generation X and Generation Y. I think that's getting a little too intense into all this. I think there's a great deal of similarity in those who have been growing up since the 90s. But there is a marked difference between that generation and previous generations. And so it's helpful, I think, to compare and contrast and ask, what is it? And needless to say, you probably guessed, I think one of the major distinctions is that this is the first postmodern generation. A generation that is really sort of swimming in the postmodern soup. But let's start by looking back a little bit at this idea of Generation X. And it became a buzzword back in 1991 when Douglas Coupland published his first book, Generation X, came out in 1991. And it was a hit because it really seemed to capture the mood of this newer group. Some people considered it the equivalent of Catcher in the Rye, which, as you know, by J.D. Salinger, was seen as the book that really summed up the mood of the 60s, sort of the zeitgeist of the 60s. But this really seemed to touch on a new generation. Generation X then quickly became a current term to reflect on a generation born after the baby boomers. The baby boomers had already been identified mostly by sociologists and marketers as a very significant demographic group who were born in large numbers towards the end of the Second World War. All the troops coming home from the war started making babies, and so you had this bulge, this sudden large number of kids born in the 50s and the 40s and the 50s, and because there are large numbers there, you know, commercial interest was high. Lots of people we can sell stuff to. So the needs and the interests and the habits of the baby boomers were studied in great detail. The baby boomers grew up in a period of economic growth and social improvement, the boom times after the Second World War ended. Education was a focus. Good education led inevitably to good jobs. There was a lot of optimism. Technology was advancing. Man reached the moon. There was the invention of the pill, which allowed the sexual revolution to take place, somewhat cost-free. And the baby boomers indulged this newfound wealth and technological ability and sexual freedom. And they really invented the 60s, right? Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That was the baby boomers. That's how they spent their youth. They produced the hippie. And then later on, when they got tired of that and they wanted to make some money on Wall Street, they invented the yuppie. So this generation really was a very sort of optimistic, somewhat rebellious, outward-looking generation. They went through a number of different changes. It's interesting now, as this whole baby boom generation reach the 60s and retirement, how they are dominating the cultural discussion in the United States. It's really quite sad in a way. It's like, will this generation ever shut up? You know? I mean, there's just so many of them. They just, you know, they just dominated the 60s and they dominated the 80s and now they're dominating, you know, the retirement. So all these movies coming out about people getting old and retiring and all this discussion about, you know, the bucket list and you know, we're going to go out with a bang. And it's all rather sad. Anyway, the children of the baby boomers kind of was overshadowed by the vitality of their adventuresome parents, sometimes called baby busters, because they were a much smaller demographic group. They've grown up in a very different world, a world of recession, of divorce, fragmentation and breakup of the family, of global fears, anxieties, and they are anything but optimistic, much more pessimistic group. But they're still relatively affluent because somewhat spoiled by these baby boom parents. And so because they have money, they also attracted the attention of marketers. And so really, Generation X was first studied by marketing agencies with a point of view of how can we sell to these people and get their money. And so they've been analyzed a great deal with that in mind. Clearly, I don't want to identify with that, but I do think there is a distinction between the generations, which is important to consider. So I think what we see in this new generation is not just a demographic term, but we see a new mindset. A mindset that shares certain values and attitudes. And I think in many ways we could talk about the millennial generation as a postmodern generation. Obviously, not every individual shares this. These are generalizations we're making. But I think Koopland really articulated very, very well something of the world of this generation. And his book, Generation X, is really written in quite a postmodern style. You know, sort of little blurbs on the side and lots of white space and little drawings everywhere. And, you know, it's a sort of, even the shape of the book is sort of very eclectic and rather postmodern. He himself, very interesting guy, studied art and in Canada, lives in Vancouver, and written a lot of very, very interesting interesting novels. But this one was more of an analysis, written with a lot of humor, and telling the story of three people who, as it says on the back cover here, were handed a society priced beyond their means. 20-somethings, brought up with divorce, Watergate, and Three Mile Island, and scarred by the fallout of yuppies, recession, crack, and Ronald Reagan. They represent a new lost generation. Fiercely suspicious of being lumped together as a target for advertisers, they have quit their dreary careers and cut themselves adrift in the California desert. In Palm Springs, that's where these three men, these three young people meet up. Land of the liposuction clinic and the shopping mall. Dumping ground for the dregs of American cultural memory. And he's a great observer of the superfluous aspects of culture. He was once in an interview asked to predict what Americans will be doing in the 21st century. This is in 1990. He said they will be shopping and going to jail. Unsure of their futures, they immerse themselves in a regime of heavy drinking and working at Mac jobs. And Mac jobs are low pay, low prestige, low benefit, no future jobs in the service industry. McDonald's, Mac jobs, you get it? Underemployed and overeducated, intensely private and unpredictable, they have nowhere to direct their anger, no one to calm their fears, and no culture to replace their ennui. So they tell stories. And this is basically what the book is. It's these guys hanging out and telling stories. Joking around. And as it says in his introduction, they left their lives behind them and came to the desert to tell stories and to try to make their lives worthwhile tales in the process. And there you have the sense of how do you make your life a worthwhile tale when you're living in this superficial sea. so the stories here reveal something of their inner world. The stories are wrapped around, as I said, by these sound bites. And the sound bites are really quite clever and rather funny little blurbs that capture something of the mindset. Let me see if I've got something. No, I don't have any here. Of the mindset of the Generation X. No, I don't have time to dig into those now. Let me keep going forward. But as much as there is a sort of a humor to the observations of living with all the superficial culture around them, and that's what the sound bites are all about, as witty as they are, the book actually carries a bit of a punch. Because you're sort of laughing and they're making jokes at the culture around them, but you sense their lostness. You sense them feeling, you know, nothing has any depth. You know, we're working in McDonald's and we're getting, you know, sort of plastic surgery done, and you know, we're going to our tanning booths and we're doing our shopping in our malls, and we're, you know, smoking dope and getting high, and you know, but it's all just so empty. And you pick that up and you get a sense that Copeland really feels for this generation. Not surprising, since in many ways he's a part of this generation. But this book that really, I think, highlighted more than anything his empathy with what it feels like to be lost in that kind of a world was this little book called Life After God. And this came out a few years later, after Generation X. And it's much more autobiographical than Gen X. Gen X is more sort of cultural observation. So this is more autobiographical. Came out in 1994. And here we get a glimpse of what is obviously his own journey. And I just want to read a number of quotes out of here that I think give you a sense of what it's like from the inside. I had lots of love to give. It's just that no one was taking it just then. I had thought I was finding consolation in solitude. But to be honest, I think I was only acquiring a veneer of bitterness. But connections had been made in my mind, however. Connections which are hard for me to sever, even now, 20 years later. One, that McDonald's equals evil. Two, that technology does not always equal progress. When I was younger, I used to worry about being alone, of being unlovable or incapable of love. As the years went on, my worries changed. I worried that I had become incapable of having a relationship or of offering intimacy. I felt as though the world lived inside a warm house at night, and I was outside, and I couldn't be seen because I was out there in the night. But now, I am inside that house, and it feels just the same. It's a very, very powerful insight. For years, he felt like it was all happening in there, and I'm on the outside. Now, he knows I'm on the inside, but it feels the same. That disconnection. Where is reality when everything is constructed? But loneliness had of late become an emotion I had stopped feeling so intensely. I had learned loneliness's extremes and had mapped its boundaries. Loneliness was no longer something new or frightening, just another aspect of life that, once identified, seemed to disappear. But I realized a capacity for not feeling lonely carried a very real price, which was the threat of feeling nothing at all. And again and again and again, as I talk to young people in my work at Labrie, and you get really down, so many feel dead inside, feeling nothing. It's one of the reasons why we have these horrible aberrations of self-harm and cutting rampant, or heavy drinking, or extreme sport and extreme behavior to try and feel something. Try and feel something. I've always prided myself on my lack of accent. I used to think mine was a Pacific Northwest accent from where I grew up, but then I realized my accent was simply the accent of nowhere. The accent of a person who has no fixed home in their mind. I was wondering what would be the logical end product of this recent business of my feeling less and less. Is feeling nothing the inevitable end result of believing in nothing? Read that again. Is feeling nothing the inevitable end result of believing in nothing? And then I got to feeling frightened, thinking there might not actually be anything to believe in particular. I thought it would be such a sick joke to have to remain alive for decades and not believe or feel anything. This man is not a Christian. I had been raised without religion by parents who had broken with their own pasts and moved to the West Coast and had raised us, their children, clear of any ideology in a cantilevered modern house overlooking the Pacific Ocean at the end of history, or so they had wanted to believe. The radio would be turned on, full of love songs and rock music. We believed the rock music, but I don't think we believed the love songs. Ours was a life lived in a kind of paradise, and so it rendered any discussion of transcendent ideas pointless. Politics, we supposed, existed elsewhere in a televised non-paradise. Death was simply something similar to recycling. Life was charmed without politics or religion. It was the life of children of the children of the pioneers. Life after God. A life of earthly salvation on the edge of heaven. Perhaps this is the finest thing to which we can aspire. This life of peace. The blurring between dream life and real life. And yet I find myself speaking these words with a sense of doubt. I think there was a trade-off somewhere along the line. I think the price we paid for our golden life was an inability to fully believe in love. Instead, we gained an irony that scorches everything it touches. And I wonder if this irony is the price we paid for the loss of God. I can't tell you how stunned I was when I first read this. I'm not a Christian. Someone who really understands something has happened. You know, the children are the children of the pioneers. You know, there's generations have come. Our generation, our parents, our baby boomers, they broke from their past and they try to raise us clean of any idea or any religion on an earthly paradise, wealthy. Do whatever you want. But something was lost. Something was traded. We don't believe in anything. Maybe that's why we can't feel anything. All we are left with is irony. Nothing to believe in. Just irony. This is the price we paid. Perhaps because we broke way back from God. Just the thought he has. I think Koopland really very movingly penetrates to the heart of the postmodern generation. And it sort of raises the question of what would create this kind of inner lostness, this kind of dislocation. We've already, I think, in our little survey of Western history and the change in worldviews, I think we've already touched on some of the things that will be obvious as factors explaining this. But let me just go through them again quickly. I think we can consider the social context first for this generation. I mean, they are the first generation to really feel...
Can I ask you a question? Mm,
so, yes.
You're talking about Generation X. Mm. Are you saying that Generation X is still where people are at now, the young people of today, or are you going to say that we've moved on from Generation
no,
X?
No, I think, I prefer to use the phrase millennial generation.
Okay, so what are you saying? Being a non-postmodern sort of person, I like to have a few facts in. Because I remember back in the 90s being told, lectured, that Generation X was roughly those who'd been born between 64 and 84.
Yeah.
So those that roughly were born since 1984, who are now, how old were you born?
91.
So these young, nice young men here. you know, I think there's something different about these guys here now, you know, the youth of today, than there is about the youth of my generation, who were Team Generation X. I mean, are you using the term millennial generation to mean, you know, basically 64 onwards?
Yes.
Or, okay.
Yeah, I think...
Okay, so this is me then. Right. Find out what I'm like.
Yeah. No, that's exactly...
I mean, my parents are baby boomers.
Yeah.
Definitely. Right. And some of the things that you were talking about, being grown up in through recession and all of that stuff, is definitely, you know, what I can relate to. But other things, I don't relate to at all, because that's not where...
Yeah, well, you know, every couple of years, you know, pop stars change, fashions change. So there are these sorts of changes you can map as time goes along. But I think that, and of course you could talk about, you know, Generation Y and, you know, the next generation after that. But I do think there was a significant break between the baby boom.
Yeah.
And then all who have followed.
Okay.
That's what I'm trying to say. All who have followed.
Right. Okay.
And
so
I'm using Generation X because as I read this, I think guys this age can relate.
Can you relate, guys?
Yeah.
Maybe not each individual, because we're generalizing.
Yeah, and maybe not in every way.
And back in the 90s, not everyone would necessarily have fitted this picture either.
No.
Because we're generalizing.
We are generalizing.
So there are individuals who will say, well, I only share that in part. But in general, I do think that there's a commonality there.
So what you're saying is, what previously people have said, there's Generation X, there's Generation Y, and there's Generation whatever's next, you're saying actually they're all quite similar in lots of ways and have lots of things, and so therefore you're grouping them together into the millennial generation.
That's exactly right.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
But I think I feel a distinct difference the way you read it. 60s to 80s and to our friend here. We were questioning that period. What you are reading is the questioning period. Modern, the what I call the generation 21, does not question at all. They have taken it, as yesterday we heard his son saying, why do you want to find meaning? Here is a journey to find meanings and frustration of not having meanings. But modernity, today's generation, the G21,
has
not wanting to find meaning. Is it that that's gone? That's an absolutely meaningless effort to do. We live without meaning, and that's our meaning. Mm-hmm. I think that there is a distinct difference.
Well, you know, I don't want us to get into too many debates about just... because we are making generalizations here, and so we need to understand that they're all going to be approximations. And what I was reading there was a sentiment of a lostness that is given up on the search. The 60s generation was looking for meaning as well. That's why they all went on the hippie trail. But they had an optimism about figuring out life. When we turn around and we get the generation change, the pessimism is the thing that's a real marker. Now, I think we're going to need to keep going.
Because
I think we're just going over similar ground here. Exactly. And we could let me get through some of this and we can come back. I'm just trying to give us a feel for where many, many young people are at, which is lost. And feeling it in a very deep inner way, which the baby boomers didn't. The baby boomers had an inner confidence, which was maybe unmerited, but they had it. This newer generation, and there are differences, and we could talk a long time, I've looked into the differences, but right now I want to look at the shift, you know, from a confident generation that grew up perhaps with the modernist backdrop to a different generation that has a postmodern backdrop and is trying to deal with it in all kinds of different ways. So,
just a quick question. When we talk about meaning, I think the fundamental question is the quest for meaning the quest for God?
Not necessarily. That's right. It doesn't necessarily. In fact, you know, it's very unusual that Kuplan actually puts God in. That's the first time he mentions God right at the end, towards the end of his book. He's not a Christian, but he's trying to put a word to something that's been lost. But it started out with maybe meaning. You know, trying to make my life meaningful. That's how he introduced these stories of these young people. And for others, it's just a matter of feeling. Just trying to feel something or finding love. A lot of people want to, you know, I have the accent of someone who doesn't have a fixed home. A lot of people just want to find home, want to belong. I wanted somewhere to belong. These are all manifestations that one sees in this grouping, this millennial generation.
If the quest for meaning, the quest for God, that's a great opportunity for Christians to learn gospel.
Exactly. Exactly. Let me move on just a little bit. I want to talk a bit about the sociological context for this generation, because I think they have really begun to experience the negative side effects of modernity. I think they have seen that, you know, the economy doesn't always just grow. There can be recession. They've recognized that the adventure of high mobility and being able to travel also leads to loneliness and alienation. They've seen that free love that their parents indulged can lead to sexually transmitted diseases and AIDS. This is the first generation to really have grown up through the breakdown of the family. This is an incredibly unprecedented demolition of the nuclear family, which for millennia in cultures of incredible diversity around the world, the families have all stuck together through thick and through, and through droughts and famines and wars. Here in the indulged West, 50% divorce rate, blended families, very, very complex and fragmented family situations that young people are growing up in the midst of today. Highly educated, the most highly educated generation ever, but very little sense of direction. Very little sense that this education is going to lead to a career, to a prosperity, and to a vocation. In many ways, this generation is all dressed up and no place to go. They have all these gifts and abilities, but they really don't know what to do with them, where to go with them. The number one question I get asked, what should I do with my life? What should I do with my life? Modernism and the machineries of modernity has created an incredibly stimulating, overstimulating, artificial, superficial environment. It's sort of cultural caffeine, just being mainlined continuously. This is what we grow up in. A barrage of highly stimulating, mediated information. This is the kind of social context. Ideologically, on the intellectual level, this is the first generation to really absorb the modern, postmodern shift. And in the classes that they take in their university education, almost a third now of young people are going into university. And the academy is dominated by different degrees of postmodern relativism, at the very least, deep skepticism. And so what they grow up with is this notion that everything is perspectival. Everything is a matter of your own beliefs and perspectives. There are no overarching frameworks that you can rely on. All authorities are corrupt. All claims to truth are just power games, power grabs. There are no fixed points. There are no foundations. Foundationalism is evil. There are no absolutes. Absolutes lead to absolutism and tyranny. So this is a world that gives them no context to gain any kind of direction, gives them no reference points, offers them this playful indeterminacy of completely unrestrained freedom, pluralism that doesn't just affirm the other's voice, but actually renders your voice just meaningless. Like the hundreds of thousands who have hungrily thrust into the blogosphere to blog their lives, to make it significant, and no one is reading them, because who could possibly read the hundreds of thousands of blogs that are out there? And what a sad juxtaposition of, yes, we have a voice because the high-tech, pluralistic, you know, the correlation of high technology and pluralistic mindset, it's a flat earth, now everyone is equal, we all have the same voice, we all have the same voice, and so no one can hear a thing because there's so much noise. So everyone stops listening. So this intellectual vacuity, this metaphysics of flux, no form, just flux, means that we have nothing but the journey to comfort us. We can forget about a destination. The idea of home just can only be ironically laughed at, because who could ever settle? And anyway, settling is evil, isn't it? So you just float. The logic of all this is a kind of nihilism. Not necessarily in the Nietzschean way, a kind of affirmative nihilism. You know, a will to power, but rather a received nihilism. There's no meaning. It's empty. All I can hope for is what I can put in. All I can hope for is what I put in. One distinction I see between the 90s and the noughts is in the 90s, a lot of people just dropped out in the face of this. The sort of slackers. couch surfers, just drop out. But in the north, you can't completely drop out, you got to eat. And eventually you realize you got to eat. And so what I see as a despair in the 90s was transformed into a neurotic anxiety in the noughts. But the root is the same. It's the same lost, no direction, no foundation. Any meaning in life I have to somehow make. In the 90s it's like, I'm just going to smoke a joint and hang out on the couch. Play some computer games. But after a while, you get hungry. All right. Then you get anxious. So then you think, maybe mom's right. Maybe I need to, you know, study harder. Maybe I need to, you know, if I don't, I'm going to die. And so there's tremendous anxiety in this younger generation today. Because there's nothing out there that you can rely on. You have to make it. And this is trying to make it now and trying to walk the same path, the career path, because that's what mom and dad are telling you. That's how you make it. You know, go study. And when you got your undergraduate degree, get your graduate degree. And then you got to take out all your loans and you got to pay back your loans. And there's your credit cards and there's retail therapy, which makes your credit cards go up higher. And this is what you're carrying. And you're trying to walk the dream of the careers that your parents had. But you don't have the inner confidence that they had, which they didn't deserve. They received it from the great generation and just ate it all up, ran on confidence. This generation is trying to do the same thing without the same inner confidence. And so anxiety levels are like this. And the neurotic fallout of OCD type behaviors, huge. So there is a transition generationally happening, but it's only a minor change within a bigger picture. Psychologically, we've talked sociologically, we've talked intellectually, the intellectual side of it, the ideological side. Psychologically is where you see the biggest damage taking place. Can I finish, buddy? The psychology is where you see the biggest problem. Because there, I think, a lot of all this crashes in on the person. And one sees the loss of identity, insecurity, depression, some of these eating disorders, self-harm, suicide, of course, it's been around for a while, but it's almost getting to the point where people are too anxious now to kill themselves. It's a very sad situation. It's a very sad situation. Looking outward, there's nothing to offer hope. I mean, families are shot. You know, parents have betrayed you. Politics is just corrupt. There's no one to trust. Nothing to believe in. Courtney Love, who was married to Kurt Cobain. Kurt Cobain was the lead singer of Nirvana, a sort of post-punk band, grunge band. He killed himself in despair in the 90s. In many ways, he symbolized the first phase of Gen X, despair. I'm not going to sell out. Killed himself. His wife was left behind. She represents something of the second phase. Well, I'm not going to kill myself, but I need to survive. So she's like on this desperate trying to get there. But she once was doing a concert in New York, and she was, you know, playing this with Hole, her band. And she suddenly stopped the music, shut up, turn up the lights. And all the crowd were looking, and she said, I'm so sick to death of this effing agnostic generation. Find something to believe in. So she yelled out at her audience. Just this desperate sense, we need something to believe in. So this is, I think, the cash value. You know, we were talking worldviews, all very analytical, all very, you know, academic, philosophical. But ideas have consequences. And what's in your head is eventually going to affect what's in your heart and how you live your life. And I think we have a postmodern generation that is highly confused, searching for meaning, identity, and behind that we would say that Copeland is right. There is a price that has been paid for the loss of God. There's a price that's been paid. He doesn't finish the book with that last quote. This is what he says in the last page of the book. It's absolutely amazing. Now, here is my secret. I tell it to you with an openness of heart that I doubt I shall ever achieve again. And I've read all his books, and he never did achieve it again. He's written a lot after this. Wonderful books, very insightful. But he's as honest here as he ever was in any other books. I doubt I shall ever achieve again. So I pray that you are in a quiet room as you hear these words. My secret is that I need God. That I am sick and can no longer make it alone. I need God to help me give because I no longer seem capable of giving. To help me be kind as I no longer seem capable of kindness. To help me love as I seem beyond being able to love. I don't believe he's become a Christian, sadly, but he's come as close as you could from out of that world. And here you have this guy just, I need God. He needs God. And that's where we come in. That's apologetics. Apologetics isn't only coming up with clever answers to clever arguments from clever people like Richard Dawkins. It is that, and we need the books and the debaters, and we need to contend with these intellectual arguments. That's apologetics. But apologetics is also recognizing that these ideas cash out in people's lives in all kinds of ways that leave people lost and hurting, and we have hope to offer. And an apologist is someone who gives a reason for the hope that we have. So we can offer hope to people that is a reasonable hope. And so as you speak into the lives of people like this, empathetically understanding where they're at, coming alongside, speaking hope, try to speak that hope credibly. We have to find ways to show how the postmodern perspective is not the only one. We need to be able to help them see that the biblical worldview is credible and it offers real hope. And that's a tricky thing to do because it's both intellectual, you have to have real discussions. This generation is highly educated, they're highly cynical, and they've thought about why they're highly cynical. They may not be asking questions like, you know, the baby boomers, but they're still thinking, and they're highly thoughtful. And they've thought very, very deeply about why they don't believe in anything. So if you're going to help them come to believe in something, you're going to have to think and unravel that thought process. But as you do so, it's going to have to be done in a context of an empathetic relationship. Because this is a hurting generation and a despondent generation. And they're not going to have the enthusiasm of the baby boomers to go out and get it. So we're going to have to go and get them. Will.
I was just thinking about, so at the moment we're kind of governed mainly by baby boomers still, I guess, like guys who are getting on a little bit. Just thinking about how...
They have a wonderful plan for your life. Yes. You're right.
The sort of apathy of this generation and the sort of 70s, 80s kind of generations, like, who's going to take over is what I'm thinking. It's like, what kind of, I mean, so people still in government now, like, I'd say Cameron is quite a modernist, he's quite into the idea of, like, absolute value of society sort of helping itself out, but who's going to come in when it's these kind of generations, like, if people are thinking postmodern terms, who's going to even bother to govern? What your view might be on that.
Well, you know, again, we're generalizing, so not everyone is as steeped in this as everyone else. And, you know, there are people who aren't and who have sort of found a way out. And there is a process of growing up in which you kind of figure some things out one way or the other. And then there are times when responsibility falls on your lap. Like when you have a kid. And suddenly you've got to grow up. There's a lot of older folk who are in positions of responsibility who still have this locked up inside of them. But they've kind of had to show up. And, you know, that's a lot of what we're seeing. That we have, I think, people rising in power who are hollow men. They've figured out ways to make it work on the outside, and sometimes you can have a bit of a career and you can, you know, the whole celebrity thing and the celebrity dimension of politics is extremely dangerous, because the one thing this generation does know how to do is celebrity. We know how to line up for American Idol, and we know what it takes. We may not have what it takes, but we know what it takes. And so that mindset then gets mapped onto politics, and you have politicians who know what it takes, superficially. But do they have what it takes? Internal, character, sense of rootedness. Sometimes they're empty inside, just like what I'm describing. But they've kind of figured it out here, and they rise. They rise. And that's extremely worrying. It's extremely worrying because you're vulnerable. You're vulnerable at that point to collapse.
But sometimes, I mean, we do, in a sense, get lucky, don't we? And we need to acknowledge that, and that sometimes these hollow men rise.
Yes.
And they realize that they need to become solid.
Yes.
And they do, by being in the job, become solid.
That's right.
That does happen sometimes.
Yeah. And I must say, you know, when I, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, I was about as despondent as the generation I've been describing. Because as I work with young people and just get into their lives, I just felt, you know, how are these young people going to come out of this? I mean, just the family situations alone. I mean, the first generation to have such a terrible experience of family. In all of history, you know, we're talking about something unprecedented in history. You know, to grow up in with such a... And, you know, then everything else that's going, all this postmodern mumbo-jumbo, you know, nothing. But I must say, I feel more encouraged, because it's amazing, as you say, God, in his general work, you know, is so merciful. You know, and he loves us, and he knows our plight. And it's amazing out of what broken, barren, you know, lands, you know, wonderful fruit will come. And I see young lives just, you know, by the grace of God being fleshed out and finding ways. Now, we can't just rely on that miracle. We have to be church to people. We have to be, you know, God in their lives. We have to be his hands and arms of love into their lives. We need to reach in. So we need to be his agents. We need to do that. But what gives me confidence is not that I think, you know, how can I help this person? It's just impossible. But I have seen. So I feel more encouraged now with this generation that they are surviving, and many, many are putting it together. And many of them are realizing, you know, we need to lay a foundation. We need to find some fixed points. And we can. And it's wonderful, and it's a miracle, I think. Because, I mean, if you really look at it like this, you think, it's hopeless. But it's not hopeless. You're absolutely right. And I hope I don't want to leave you feeling. I want you to really feel the impact of these ideas. But I don't want to leave you sort of feeling like, well, that's it, you know. Yeah.
And I feel particularly encouraged, because I think for the Christian there's much hope. especially if Krishna finds himself in that, you know, world, feeling of despair. At some points it felt like you were reading my journals.
Yeah.
But there's hope, because somehow in the grappling for God and meaning and purpose and all those grandiose ideas, you develop a greater sensitivity for people who struggle like that without God. You know, like Solomon had everything and he felt like life was meaningless, and so we're not, immune to those feelings even as a Christian. But somehow in all of that, the Lord can develop a particular sensitivity and compassion,
yes,
and capacity to reach out to people, because you well know the struggle and you know the search.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Ernest. Sufant?
I feel like I've run out of my quota of questions.
No, that's okay. I'll just ignore you when you run out.
And obviously, we'll say no question.
I'll let you know when you run out.
We have come to that friendship now. You can help each other. I feel there is this is a comment. I feel your analysis is absolutely valid. Valid in the context of a Western world, because you are a Westerner. Mm-hmm. You're talking to a highly Western audience.
Yeah.
The other side of the mirror is slightly different. India being the largest, one of the largest population countries in the world, having per capita income is half than any average European, has not gone through what you are highlighting. So it is because your entire analysis is about the social, but not about the structure. We have moved away from God, but the West has created other gods.
Yes.
So moving away from God and creating other gods are two different. The East is still struggling. They may move away from God, but they are not still construct. Maybe China and India are 20 years now construct their own gods. Therefore, we still have the least suicide, least divorce rates, one of those social indicators, indexes that shows up. I believe analyzing the social also have to go hand in hand with analyzing the structure. The last 300 years of the growth of capitalism, industrialization, post-industrial anxiety is one of the things that the West is dealing and West has to be. So all what you are explaining has those characteristics.
Yeah.
Why is that? My question, now that's my comment, my question is, why is that the evangelical church worldwide, particularly the enlightened evangelical church, what you represent, is reluctant and refusing to criticize that capitalistic order the West is governed today?
Well, I don't think that's uniformly true. I mean, I think there are substantive and very, very radical critiques coming from the church with regard to industrialized society, with regard to capitalism, and so on. I think perhaps they don't cash out as much as because the alternatives are not all that clear. You know, one of the things we've sort of figured out over the 20th century is that the socialist and communist wing of how to manage society didn't really work all that well either. And in fact, lent itself to dictatorships. So the liberal approach is now being substantively criticized, I think it is, but in terms of what should we have in place is a little harder. And so I think it may feel as if there's no real prophetic voice into that. I'm not an economist. I think my own personal feeling is that the answer lies in none of the above. I don't believe that the answer to what you're talking about lies in figuring out how to do the economy.
No, it's all the issue of social justice. It's not a modality.
Right. But that's kind of what I'm saying. Because I think we focus on, you know, how do we manage money and structures and all, of capital and all that. But I think it's the social capital that has been squandered. And therein lies a solution, irrespective of how we deal with financial institutions and so on. I really think that I have little care or concern about economics, to be quite honest. But I think that narrowly defined in terms of finances, but I think in terms of our social institutions, there I am glad that there's a lot of voices out there concerned about the growth of the state vis-a-vis the individual and the need for intermediate institutions. And I think there's a whole vision there that is much more positive. And again, I agree with you. I think that the church needs to be more prophetic along those lines than it is. I would like to hear more voices that are much more prophetic. But that's, I think, the direction I would go. We've got to have to wrap up. Do you want a quick comment?
Comment on that. Yeah. I think that actually secularists are doing that job for us and critiquing the Denif Randolph gave the same talk as he gave us last week, social and moral bankruptcy in the country keeps coming up in the papers.
Yeah.
It's just they've realised that actually our system is rubbish and has kind of nothing going for it really, except sort of increasing
exactly.
the riches of the rich people.
So why isn't the church leading those people?
It's widespread, but I just want to repeat what I said. I think if we do participate in that, there's a danger, because I think the premise of that discussion is the system's broken, what would be a better system? And I think the premise is wrong. I don't think we should have a system. Doesn't mean I'm an anarchist, but it does mean I think that our whole conception that somehow it's really a modernist concept, that somehow there's a problem we can fix and it's this big. And I don't think we can do that. I think we're meant to play a different kind of a role prophetically. But that's a whole different discussion. Let's not stray from where we ended with Generation X. Yes, Joe.
I just thought of three songs. For the baby boomers, I Did It My Way.
Yes.
Perhaps for millennial generation, I Will Survive.
Yes.
And for Christians, Amazing Grace, which still has resonance.
It certainly does.
Among both the baby boomers and the millennial
X. It certainly does. Listen, folks, I'd like us to sort of go back a little bit, think about what we're talking about with this millennial generation and what I was saying about how do we communicate hope into this kind of mindset and heart ache. When we finish tea, I don't want us to come back here. Is that going to be all right? I want us to go straight into our groups, okay? And spend 25 minutes thinking together about that question. It's absolutely critical because there's no one way. But let's try to think together, share, encourage each other, and how we do that. And then we'll come back at that point. Is that okay? Great. All righty. Let's go for tea.